On now to a hustle from nearly a century ago. This story is about a guy who spotted a chance to make a lot of money and went for it. His name was Roy Olmsted. Back in the 1920s, during Prohibition, Olmsted supplied a dry Northwest with booze. Lots of booze. And we're not talking moonshine here. This was the good stuff. Olmsted became known as the King of the Bootleggers. But his life did not start out this way. University of Washington history professor William Rohrabaugh says that in the early 1900s, Olmsted was a Seattle police officer.
He was Scandinavian, and he had a kind of calm, deferential demeanor. He was a bit cold, perhaps, even. He was fairly tall and broad-shouldered, and I mean, he had been a police officer who could, you know, break up a barroom fight, so he had size on his side.
Rohrabaugh talks with Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing about how Olmsted's hustle ended up, in a roundabout way, strengthening the civil liberties we still enjoy today. He says Olmsted quickly rose through the ranks of Seattle's police department, becoming the youngest lieutenant on the force.
He was very bright, capable. People thought of him as maybe someday a future police chief.
How does he go from being a rising star in the police force to getting into distributing alcohol, which was illegal?
There were people in high places who kind of encouraged him to do this. They saw that prohibition wasn't going to work. It was going to stop legal drinking. It wasn't going to stop drinking. And therefore, there would be a lot of illegal drinking. And this was bound to produce a lot of crime and criminal gangs that would take over this business. And I think they kind of encouraged him to get into the business in order to stop people who were worse from being in the business. And of course, why did he do it? Well, he later said after he was out of prison, he did it for the money. I mean, why else would you do it? You know, there was a lot of money involved.
Yeah. How much are we talking about?
Oh, he said that there were thousands of dollars a week.
A week?
A week, yeah. Maybe $200,000 a year, maybe.
How did he do this?
A lot of it was actually geography. It was the simple fact that Seattle is very close to Canada. Canada did not have prohibition. And what you had to do was find a way to get the liquor across the international border. That was the gist of it. And Olmsted's particular technique for doing it was pretty imaginative. He went up to Vancouver and he would buy Canadian liquor, and then he would load it onto Canadian boats and take these ships, fairly large ships, out into the Pacific Ocean, international waters, and then he would, at night, load the liquor onto small, fast boats that he purchased. And those small, fast boats would come back into Puget Sound during the night and would drop the liquor off on different beaches. And then car caravans would come to those beaches by some kind of prearranged signal, hopefully before someone else got there, right? And pick up the liquor and take it back to Seattle.
And how did people know where to pick up these crates of alcohol on these random beaches?
The king of the rum runners had the answer to that. He lived in Mount Baker, and which is high up, right? It's on a hilltop. And he suddenly started operating a radio station out of his house, which seemed like a very odd idea. And the radio station at night, his wife, Elsie, would read children's stories. And apparently the children's stories contained secret coded messages about where the beaches were that you would pick up the liquor and what time the liquor would be there.
What did he say he was doing? What was his public persona? What business, in quotation marks and air quotes, was he running?
Oh, well, he had a really good one, didn't he? What would you do if you were hiring people to go around and do secretive things? He's a former police officer. He was a private detective, right?
No. Who were his clients?
Oh, the wealthiest people in Seattle. He served the hotels that supposedly were dry, the speakeasies, the high-end speakeasies. The reason people wanted liquor from Olmsted and were willing to pay higher prices is that his liquor was not moonshine.
How did the end come for the king of the rum
runners? Yes, well, the king fell from his throne, didn't he? There were people in Washington State who very much favored prohibition. And in fact, the voters had put state prohibition in even before national prohibition. So this was a dry state. And the leader of that politically was a senator, U.S. senator named Wesley Jones. And he was determined personally to get rid of Roy Olmsted. He saw Roy Olmsted as mocking this law. So Olmsted could pay off the police. He could pay off the mayor's office. But the one group that Olmsted could never control was the Federal Prohibition Bureau, because it was under the patronage control of Senator Jones. And so the King of the Rum Runners had an office in downtown Seattle overlooking Pioneer Square, I believe. And the feds decided that they would wiretap Roy Olmsted's office telephone downtown. And most of the phone calls were totally innocuous. And the person would say, you know, 4th and Marion or some address. You know, and then that would be it. And then Olmsted would hang up. And they said, we have enough evidence that there's something funny going on because this guy's not talking on the phone in a normal way.
It's not what he's saying, it's what he's not saying.
You're right. Let's have a search warrant for his house. I think it was like a Friday night. It was a party night. I know that. And the feds, you know, raided the place and found the liquor that was going to be distributed at the end of the party, as well as, of course, the liquor was going to be served at the party. But more important, they found all the records. So, I mean, his attorney says, look, the wiretap was illegal, and therefore the search warrant was illegal, and therefore this whole case is illegal. The searches are illegal without warrants, but whether tapping somebody's phone wire constitutes a search is a really interesting legal question in 1924.
So this is uncharted territory.
It's uncharted territory legally. There's no law against it, but there's also no law that allows it, and the judge isn't buying any of Olmsted's lawyer's argument and says, doesn't seem like it's an illegal search to me. So he loses the case and is convicted. And then his attorney says, but we could win on appeal. And so it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 ruling, ruled against Olmsted. Chief Justice William Howard Taft hated prohibition, absolutely despised it, disapproved of it totally.
So you would think he would rule in Olmsted's favor.
But he argued with his colleagues on the court, if we let bootleggers like Olmsted off on technicalities, which is what this is, then we'll never get rid of the 18th Amendment. The only way we can get rid of that amendment is if we convict them. We have to crack down on bootleggers and make it hard for people to get liquor. And then people will scream, get rid of the amendment. So the court, 5-4, it shows you that, you know, some of the justices didn't buy that argument, obviously. But there's a huge outcry in the legal community from attorneys who say, this should be covered by the Fourth Amendment. No one should have a right to tap somebody's telephone like that without a warrant. And Congress in the 1930s passes a statute that specifically prohibits a wiretap without a warrant. So Congress settled the matter eventually.
And Roy Olmsted goes to prison.
He's sentenced to 5 years, I believe, at McNeil Island. And by the time he's released, prohibition is about over. And while he's in prison, he has a religious conversion experience and becomes a Christian Scientist and becomes totally dry. And he becomes a furniture salesman for a while. And later he becomes a full-time Christian Science practitioner. It is also suspected, although no one can prove it, that he probably had money in bank accounts in Vancouver. The feds would have been willing to maybe even give him a very light sentence instead of 5 years if he'd been willing to tell everything.
But he never did.
But he never did. And even his children said he never would talk about it. He just said, that was then, this is now.
William Rarbaugh, a professor of history at the University of Washington, thank you so much for joining us on Sound Effect.
You're welcome.
And we should tell our listeners that you have a book coming out in the fall called Prohibition, A Concise History.